Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils, you'll want to invite everyone over, from book club to the fantasy league, even the in-laws.
It smells amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Scented Oils are infused with 2 times more natural essential oils versus regular Airwick scented oils for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Transform your space with scents like white sage and mahogany or lavender and water lily. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
Fans, July's underway, and it's a great month for sports. If you're into sports betting, BetOnline is where you can find it all, from the NBA and hockey playoffs to baseball's marquee matchups, including prop bets and futures. BetOnline has all the latest odds, news, and information for all of your online sports betting needs. Visit the website today or use your mobile device to join and receive 50% welcome bonuses on your first deposit. So before the next tip-off, face-off, or pitch, head on over to BetOnline and start playing today. BetOnline, your online sportsbook experts. Welcome again, everybody, and thanks so much for subscribing, rating, and reviewing us. Mike, Mark, and Barry with you on this episode, and we've got another Hall of Fame edition of Major League Beginnings. Our guest spent his entire 20-year career with Houston, was a 7-time All-Star, had more than 3,000 hits, and was the first player to be enshrined in Cooperstown wearing an Astros cap. And guys, I know we're all excited to have Craig Biggio with us.
Mike, I am so excited because when you think of Craig Biggio, obviously you think of the Houston Astros, but you also think of a dirty helmet, the pine tar on the back of Biggio, doubles, the way he led off games, and also his unselfishness throughout his career really resonates with me. Can't wait to hear his Hall of Fame stories.
Well, Craig, 20-year Hall of Fame career, and frankly, any chance we get to touch base with Buddy of Barry's and Mark's is a thrill for all of our listeners. So thanks so much for the time.
Glad to be part of it. Thanks for asking me.
You know, when we look back at your body of work, which is extraordinary, and most of our listeners are familiar, more than 3,000 hits, more than 600 doubles, the numbers I could list ad nauseum possibly, but it's the memories that seem to stick with you guys the most. When you look back at your career, what is that signature moment for you?
You know, it's a good question. People ask me that a lot. Like, what do you remember the most? What is and to me, I can't just answer one thing. I think it's kind of accumulation of three different things. One would be, you know, being part of the Houston Astros for 20 years and being loyal and committed to one city, one organization. Two would be, you know, obviously going to the World Series. We talked about the World Series. And then finally, I think it was after whatever it was, 18 years, and finally getting there and giving that to the fan base or to the state of Texas, because Texas is never to the World Series. So to be part of that was pretty cool. The end result wasn't, you know, and then the accumulation of being loyal to one organization, one city, and to get accepted into the Hall of Fame and to be able to give that back to the fans was really, so it's kind of, for me, it's not just the one signature moment. I mean, I left out the 3,000 hits too, because that's another, you know, the 3,000 hits was, you know, again, to give that back to the fans, to my family, you know, to be able to do that, you know, it was really special. So I guess it'd be those four things. I'm sorry, it's just not one, but it's just kind of like, you know, after 20 years, you have a lot of things that happen to you. And for me, those four things were pretty special in my mind.
Was it something you anticipated happening, the idea of staying with Houston for that long? Because you get an opportunity, but you know the business of the game. Nobody really can be promised that type of
future.
Well,
again, you got Barry's on this call also. So, I mean, he's my agent, and I never wanted to leave Houston. And I think a lot of players, you know, they never really want to leave the city. They, you know, you come up through the minor leagues and you dedicate yourself there. And then all of a sudden you get to the big leagues and you want to stay, and everybody wants to be like Cal Ripken and make it last the whole time. but it's really hard to do. And I never really wanted to leave. We came close one year. I think it was like 94 or something like that, and didn't want to leave. But at the last minute and the last second, we were able to get a deal done. But it was something that it was kind of, I wanted to see the journey and the dream of getting to the World Series to the end. And then every year when you didn't get there, you're like, hey, let's go next year. Hopefully we get there next year. And then, we got to the playoffs, we changed the culture there, until we finally got to the World Series. But I never wanted to leave Houston. I love Houston. I still live in Houston, work there with the club now. But it's just something that it's hard to do. Business is business. Money is money. And players move around a lot.
Beach, there's so many things that you have to chronicle with that career, and especially a Hall of Fame career. But I think for our listeners, understanding how you pick your representative and somebody that is going to be lockstep with your career, because that's what your vision was, is how long can I stay in that same uniform, which is a challenge in this day and age. For you, choosing Barry Axelrod and how that all went down, how did that really come to fruition?
I mean, Barry, gosh, I've known Barry for over 30 something years, and we were together probably 18 of the 20 years is what it was. And, I found Barry through the clubhouse guy. Dennis Laborio was one of my best friends and had mentioned Barry. Mark Bailey had mentioned him. Rick Sutcliffe had him. And so I had the opportunity to talk to him and talk to those guys about Barry. And then after they told me a lot about Barry, I mean, I had the opportunity to meet with Barry. And then we, committed a relationship that goes to today. I mean, he's one of my best friends. And, being an agent is one thing. Players got to go play. You got to go do what you got to do. But I think sometimes people lose sight of the fact that it's a people business. And you don't necessarily have to be a jerk to get your client mm-hmm. money. I mean, your client is going to go out there and do his thing, and then you got to do the rest to make sure he gets it. But yet again, I always felt like, especially now being on the front office side, like if somebody's agent calls, you want the GM to pick up the phone call. You don't want them to say, hey, message, I'll call you back, And Barry's one of those guys that basically the GM would go right through, and then they would talk, and then they'd have a dialogue. I mean, you can go back to your days with Kevin Towers. God bless him. Love the man to death. And Kevin was an unbelievable GM. But there's the business side of it, and then there's the relationship side of it as far as, your friendship. And, you can do both. And Barry has got a special trait of being able to use his people skills, what he's got really well, and then his business side of it in order to get his clients paid and not being not being a jerk and trying to get it done.
From my point of view, thank you, Craig, for all that. But from my point of view, I don't know if we knew it at the time, but in retrospect, I can say that I think Craig and I were a perfect match because of his desire to stay with one team. I can remember early in our relationship, we were talking and Craig said something like, how when you look at somebody's baseball card and you see on the back how they're with the same team for all those years, and it looks so clean and neat. That's how I want my baseball card to be. And I remember that. And I was always of the philosophy that, of course you want to get as an agent, you want to get your client as much money as you can. But I thought more important with that than that was to make them comfortable and therefore have a best chance for success. And Craig made it known, and I admire it greatly. And I'm very proud of the fact that I had a part in pulling it off to keep him with the same team for his entire career, which is virtually unheard of anymore. And we went through we'll eventually talk about the free agency situation. We went through some trials and tribulations. It wasn't always easy, but the end result is there, and I'm proud of it, along with Craig.
So our listeners have frame of reference. I want to make sure I get this right. Craig played in the big leagues from 1988 until 2007. Barry, you guys got together in 1990?
90-ish? 91.
Okay. 91. Craig, let's turn the clock back. As we mentioned, you were drafted in 1987 in the first round by the Houston Astros. You break into the big leagues, 1988, and you play till 2007. So in 1988, in June, you get the call. Walk us through, if you would, who told you, how you found out, and how that whole story developed.
It was kind of cool because, you know, my mom and dad were divorced, you know, when I left to go play my professional career. So my mom made it a trip to come out to Tucson, and that's where our AAA club was. And so we got her some seats right next to the dugout. And I was playing left field that day. I don't know why, but I was out in left field. And then I remember the manager was Bob Didier. And he told my mom, "Hey, I just want to let you know something, that your son's going to get called up to the big leagues after this game is over." So he told my mom before I knew. And then actually, you know, I saw my mom after the game, gave her a hug. And then I said, "Let me go shower and I'll see you after the game." So anyway, you know, you go into the locker room and then the manager calls in your office. So you're either getting sent down, getting traded, or getting called up. So it's one of the three. So, and I got the best that he said, "Hey, listen, man, you're going to the big leagues, and we're going to put you on a red eye, and we're going to fly into Houston. They got a day game tomorrow." It's like, and then, so obviously, you know, getting the call, you know, getting called up is one thing. But, you know, obviously to be able to enjoy that moment with my mom, God bless her, she's no longer here anymore. And she loved baseball. And so to be able to have that moment with her was really cool.
Greg, what about your dad? How did you let your dad know? He wasn't in Tucson. So how did that come about?
I had to reach out to him. He was still an air traffic controller. I mean, cell phones weren't like they are nowadays. So I left him a message at his house, and then I had the opportunity to call him later on. And then he eventually made it to Houston. I think it was a week later or so.
Well, take us through that, Craig. You take the red eye flight. You have the day game the next day. Did you find out that you were in the lineup? How did that go down when you went into the locker room?
Well, you know, you get into the locker room, you come right from the airport, you go right to the locker room. And then Dennis Laborio, like I said before, he was the equipment guy, he's one of my best friends, and God bless him. He's no longer here either. He said there's a little bunk room in the back. So, you know, go get a couple hours sleep back there, and then we'll come get you around 9 o'clock or whatever. And so you go, it's kind of like a kid at Christmas Eve, you know what I mean? Like, dude, I'm in the big leagues. I'm 22 years old. I got Nolan Ryan is going to be dressing next to me over here. Like, all of a sudden, like, I'm going to try to go to sleep for a couple hours. So anyway, I fake sleeping. The manager called me in his office. He goes, "Hey kid, I know you got in late. You know, can you play?" I'm like, "Dude, I'm 22 years old. Let's go." I don't need any sleep. Right. So went out and, I played that day. I didn't get a hit or whatever, but I remember I threw Jose Uribe out, I think, was trying to steal, and I think we won the game. But yeah, it was a moment that you never forget.
Craig, when you walk in that locker room, and obviously you're fake sleeping, but I think it always resonates with me, those jerseys around the locker room. What was that first impression when you saw Biggio on the back part of that jersey?
Well, as you know, I mean, it's something that you dream about. You know what I mean? There's a lot of uniforms that you've put on, and, you know, they're, you know, maybe an A-ball, AA, AAA college, or wherever you're at. And then you go to the spring training, and you're in spring training, big league camp, but you're not in the big leagues yet. And then all of a sudden to have, you know, your name, and you've got a Nolan Ryan, a Mike Scott, a Billy Doran, a Buddy Bell. Okay. He was like 42, 43. I don't even know how old he was. He was awesome teammate. You know, and then you just look around the locker room and you're like, "Whoa, I'm not going to talk a lot around here."
Yeah. Back in the day, it wasn't let the kids play or let the kids speak. So you walk in that locker room, and you mentioned Buddy Bell, you mentioned a bunch of names. Who was the most influential, to you, that basically took you under their wing and showed you the ropes?
You know, Billy Doran was great. You know, getting the opportunity, obviously, see Nolan Ryan prepare for the his starts and catch him, Mike Scott, all the guys in the bullpen. You got to remember, I was a catcher. So, I mean, you know, you got different personalities and different people you got to learn. But you just had the opportunity, you know, and mentioning those guys to 22 years old, you get the opportunity to watch them and they have a good game or a bad game, and you watch how they handle the media. And the way they handle people day in and day out, and the way that they handle, you know, just everything, the way that it goes to being a professional. And I owe myself, and Barry, and I've told Barry this before, and I've told many other people before, I am so indebted to you know, the players that I broke in with, because of the fact of the matter is that I was 22. The next closest guy to me was 32. So there's a generational gap in between 10 years of like, wow, I just stepped, what did I step into? And I just learned from those guys. And that was three of the great before. And then we revamped the whole team in 91 or 92, whatever year it was. But I mean, I had the opportunity to be around those guys for 2.5 years and watch those guys prepare. And you know it yourself, you know, like you watch these guys prepare, you watch how they handle themselves. You watch Tony Gwynn do his thing, how Tony Gwynn would take extra batting practice or do the extra little things to make him be so great. And when you're a younger player, having the opportunity to watch these guys do that, that was pretty special.
You know, Craig, you mentioned revamping the team after a couple of years. Part of that revamp, and one of the first things that I encountered with you was your position change. And from my point of view, you make the All-Star team for the first time as a catcher, and they come to you and say, oh, you know, that's nice, but we want to move you to second base. I recall from my point of view saying, wait, if you're going to do that, we need a little more security. And we asked for a 2-year deal and they complied and took care of that security. But tell us how that position change went down from your point of view.
Well, I mean, again, you're talking about things were speculated, you know, because you can run. He's not always going to stay behind a plate. He's going to do the, you know, we don't want to lose his speed. That's kind of one of his main assets that he has. I did have a good arm when I was younger. Until as time goes on, it doesn't get as good. It gets beat up a little bit. But I think it was just kind of was speculated. And then it was at that stage where Billy Doran was older, was going to become a free agent. And then the club was like, all right, if we're going to do this, we got to do this now. And I'm not going to say it didn't go over. You know, the switch went as well as it could go. And I had Matt Galante, who was, you know, he's like a father figure to me, who I mean, the hours that we spent. And I'm going to be honest, we went from 7 a.m. to 8:30 and we go in at spring training and towel off and then go back out and do the regular stuff with the team, grab a quick sandwich, and then we go get more work done on the backfield. Then we dry off and then go play the game. And then when the game is over, we go back to this turf field and do it all over again. So the transition itself was really hard. But in the beginning, it was, you know, the decision was like, man, this is kind of like, this is like, it's never been done before. Like it could go really well, it could not go well, or it could go really bad. And, you know, we always were positive about it. And we were like, listen, if we're going to make this work, we're going to make it work and be the best second baseman we can be. And that was the mindset on it. And then we went out there and did it, but it wasn't, it was a lot of work that went into it.
When you go through that type of process, I would imagine, I mean, you may have some self-doubt. The coaches are trying their best to probably alleviate that, but even teammates are going, I don't know if we can do this. I don't know if we can feel a level of trust. What was your vibe going through it? Did you have any doubt? Could you feel any questioning around you, or did you feel you had complete support?
Well, I had complete support of my teammates and everything like that. And you know, these things happen in baseball a lot of different times. I'm not going to say actually going from catcher to second base, because that's really, you know, unheard of. But again, it was kind of like, you know, if we're going to do this, we're going to become the best possible second baseman that I can become, whatever that's going to be. So we're going to go out and we're going to put the amount of time in that we can and the work in that we can. And then like I said, just try to become the best possible second baseman you can be. My teammates have my support, have my back from the standpoint. They knew I wasn't sitting in the clubhouse drinking coffee. They saw me, you know, coming in at 7 o'clock in the morning and getting work done and then going back out again and going back out again and again. And then I involved my other teammates too. So like, you know, then you're working with the shortstops, the third basemans, the first basemans and the different angles and different. So the conversation is there. You know, eventually it all worked out and, you know, the rest was history, but it was a lot of work and a lot of, like you were saying though, it was, you know, if it didn't work, what were we going to do?
Yeah. What was the backup plan, by the way?
We didn't think about that. We just kind of said, we're going to make this work. And then we did. I used the negativity because, there's probably 90% of the people said, this is never going to work. Guys have gone from catcher to first base, catcher to third base, catcher to left field or right field, but they've never gone like up the middle. Like if you're going to build a team, you're building up the middle. And they're like, you guys think you can take a kid and go from catcher to second? So I use the negativity to be my driving force to try to prove people wrong. and become the best possible second baseman, whatever that was going to be.
Beach, I think it's interesting because you mentioned Matt Galante. I think every organization has their infield instructor that really dives in and puts those finishing touches on you. You have to have that personality to take on that challenge, which I think buying into your personality is not really taking it to another level. We all know you love taking on those challenges. Let's talk about the mechanics of second base, because I've heard this before, never played the position, but when you're turning a double play, especially the slide rule now, you didn't have that slide rule back in the day. The challenges were when you're taking that throw from whether third base or shortstop to turn the double play, your back is to that runner. Was that one of those things that was hard to get past, or how did you take on to those challenges?
Well, honestly, I mean, that was, you know, being a catcher, you always had a blind side too. Whenever you're taking a throw from the right fielder, you don't really see that guy. So you're vulnerable, you know, on that play. And it's very similar to the double play ball. And, you know, the double play ball is really like, there's the right way to do it. And then there's the wrong way. And the right way to do it is kind of reading the ball and then going, you know, like I have three screws on my knee from a takeout at second base. Today's game, they don't do that anymore. There's, you watch guys turn a double play ball nowadays. I mean, they would be in the hospital back in the day.
Right.
You can't, but that's just the way the rules are nowadays. So anyway, you know, but it was kind of learning how the feeds are, the throws are, and then let the throw dictate how you're going to turn it. But that really wasn't the hard part. That wasn't the hardest part for me. The hardest part of second base was the mental side of it. Like you got to remember, I was pretty much a catcher my whole life. So like every situation, every ball that was hit, man on first and second, bases loaded, fast runner at the plate, slow runner at the plate. Like when a ball was hit, when I was a catcher, I knew where everybody had to go. So now all of a sudden you're standing out there on the field and you don't have shin guards on anymore. You don't have a mask on anymore. And there's a guy on first and there's a slow runner at the plate. You got to know where to go. So for me, the hard part was thinking about like every situation that was going through my mind. You got Deion Sanders at first base that can turn a normal man as a double. He's going to turn it into a triple. You know what I mean? So it's kind of like you have to think in your mind of every situation, because I didn't want to be like, you know, the fan sitting in the stands going, something doesn't look right there. Somebody's out of position. You know what I mean? I couldn't even see the other game and go, that's not right. Right. And I didn't want to be that. So that, the physical side of it, the double plays and all that stuff was one thing, but the aspect of like knowing where you had to be on every play, that took me probably a good year and a half until I was able just to go out and relax and play the game.
You know, what's cool. I mean, we've read article after article and they wanted to keep your bat in the lineup, keep you healthy, which was part of the reason, right, to move you out from behind the plate. But before you ever make that move, when we talked about the fact that you broke in 1988 and you got your first hit, do you remember that? Because it came against the Dodgers and it was special for a couple of reasons. But let's first talk about the hit. Do you remember it?
Oh, yeah. It was a line drive up the middle off Earl Hershiser, who, I mean, he was the man back in he was about as filthy as you could get. And don't ask me, for whatever reason, I wore him out. They got to be over 400. And I don't know why throughout my career, but for some reason, I got my first hit off him and I kept getting the hits off him every time I faced him.
Oh, well, you know what? I bring up a couple of reasons why that's special to those of us who are fans of yours. And that is, yeah, you got the hit off Hershiser, but the guy you were catching that day, if you remember, was Nolan Ryan.
Right.
So here you are as a kid, 22 years old, you're facing Earl Hershiser, you're catching Nolan Ryan, you're playing on a veteran team. You got to take me in that pregame meeting with Nolan Ryan. What is that like between Nolan Ryan and a 22-year-old piss pot catcher?
Pretty much, it's like, okay. So first of all, like being 22 years old, I never got caught up with the name game. Even though you look at the nameplates and you go, damn, like, you know, there's Nolan Ryan, there's Buddy Bell. There's all, like, if I got caught up in the name game, I would have never been able to play. So I tried to treat Nolan Ryan like he's everybody else, but it was kind of like, it's so hard to do. But, you know, basically, you know, Nolan and all the older guys, it was like, I'm going to put down a one. And then if you shake, I'm going to shake, I'll do the change up. And, you know, until I get there. And pretty much it was, you know, those older guys were great for them. For me, it was really more learning, you know, where they wanted you to set up, where they wanted you to set up 0-0, where they wanted you to set up 0-2, where did you set up 1-1, you know, when you want, you know what I'm saying? Like, you know, once you get the pitch call and all that other stuff, then, but then it's the location. Cause a lot of times, you know, there's more that goes on than just a pitcher throwing the ball. Some pitchers throw to your shin guards. Some pitchers throw to your shoulders. Some pitchers want you to move outside. You know what I mean? And then they're going to, you know what I mean? So there's a little bit more involved than actually just putting a finger down and setting up and going from there.
So what did Nolan want from you?
He wanted me to block his curveball.
Uh-huh.
So he could drop that hammer and he had a nasty changeup too. And what helped me get to the big leagues is that we had two older catchers. It was Mark Bailey, who actually was one of Barry's clients. And then Alan Ashby. So I went to big league camp and I was good at that. I could block balls. I mean, I was small, agile. I could move. And Nolan, I was supposed to go to Double A, and then Nolan and these guys and the coaching staff were like, just put him in Triple A, man. Let's push him. We'll see what he can do. And then that's kind of what Nolan's biggest thing was, is really, you know, throwing that curveball and being able to block it. And that was kind of one of the things that really helped me get to the big leagues and really helped me with him. It was really just, as long as he can snap that off, you can block it. We were good.
Beige, what do you remember about your first home run? Because that's a moment I think you'll never forget.
Gosh, I got to try to remember that. Oh, that was a great one. So the first home run, I'm thinking, I got 8 at bats in the month of August. And I'm like bench boy. I'm like manager's is older team. He's managing for his job. The heck with the kid. I'm not, he's hitting 214. I'm not writing his name in the lineup. So I sat in the bullpen and I learned a lot. I mean, the conversations that you had with Dave Smith, God bless him, San Diego guy out there, was great closer we had. Larry Anderson, Danny Darwin, Juan Augusto. So having the opportunity to talk to those guys was one thing. Then all of a sudden you get an opportunity. Hey, kid, get a bat. You're going to go hit off of Goose Gossage. Like, okay, cool, man. I know Goose, man. I watched him on TV. I'm a New York kid, man. I got to go up there and I'm ready to hit. And then he throws me a heater. It was up high. And I think it hits the glove. And then I swing and I'm like, you better get it going a little quicker than that. Another heater. And I hit a Wrigley Field homer, a line drive into left center. And then as I hit, I was like, damn, I should hit a homer off of Goose Gossage, man. I was a kid. And then I hit second and the ball came flying by me because they threw it in from the outfielder. I was like, this is awesome. I hit a homer off of Goose and I'm getting the ball back.
Did you start getting it from your buddies, everybody in New York, and giving you the grief?
No, they were like, man, you hit a homer off of Goose. This is when he was in Chicago. So it was like, man, you know, because they're all Yankee fans back here. So it was kind of like,
hey, when you're living this life, and it's easy now for us to look back and pull out like little snapshots of this, but are you aware of the magnitude of some of these events as you're living them in real time in those moments?
You know, that's a really good question. I think, you know, to go back to when you're 22, 23, 24, I think that you think this is going to last forever, and it doesn't last forever, but you just try to, you're trying to live for the next year and then live for the next year after that. And then once you hit, you know, 7, 8 years, you know who you are. Teams know who you are. You have security from that standpoint. And I think you start to really enjoy things more and more. And the things that you see on the field, you enjoy more. You enjoy more. Like, I never enjoyed getting no hit. It only happened once, but it was fun to actually be part of a no hitter. You know what I mean? When Darryl Kyle threw it. And so, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, as you get older, you appreciate the game. I don't say you appreciate it more. You just see it differently. You know what I mean? Like somebody told me one time, if you read a book when you're 20, you read it when you're the same book, and you read it when you're 30, 40, and 50, you're going to view it differently because you're at different levels of your life. And that's kind of the same way in baseball, where you're kind of like, you know, when you're 20, you're just, you know, like the young dog and ready to go. And then you start chilling out and you enjoy it. And as you get older and you enjoy the game more. And then, you know, I was lucky to play to my 40s. So, you know, when you play into your 40s, you know, you appreciate the young kid and what they're able to do and what players can do on a field. So, I mean, I think it's, you know, I've been blessed from the standpoint that I think you look at it through different eyeglass at the different ages that you're at.
Yeah, Bij, I mean, you go through your career, and I think a lot of people don't realize that sometimes you have to settle in and feel like you're a big leaguer, and then you just go. And the confidence that you have already developed through your life, you just become a big leaguer. You settle in, and it's about winning. But you do that in a very good form, and you make the position change, but you also become a seven-time All-Star. And the reason why I say that, that's got to be a feather in your cap for all the work that you put in. What was that like? Does one resonate more than the other when you went to seven All-Stars?
I think I took it all. You know, I enjoyed all of them. I mean, again, it's a tremendous honor, as you know, to be able to go to an All-Star game and represent your team. Hopefully you got some teammates to come with you, and to be able to go and represent, you know, your team and then your organization and your fan base. I mean, they were all great. They're all fun. I mean, when you get that many studs, and disregard yourself because you don't look at yourself that way, but when you look at Mark McGwire and Barry Bonds, and you know, you look at all these guys, these dudes, like just for that year, is like, so it was fun. And whenever we went, we didn't have the Lear Jets back then, so it was always it was hard. You had to get on the plane and go, and you're tired, and you knew it was going to be 2 days of getting worn out and this and that. But it was so much fun. It was such an honor to go, and then you get an opportunity. You know, like you know, when you're a little kid, you watch the All-Star game. You go, man, I want to be great. Make a little league All-Star game team, you know. And then you're playing in the big leagues in an All-Star game. And so we would take as many family members as we could get, and we enjoyed every single one of them.
You know, Craig, after all, or during all this success, being a seven-time All-Star, in the middle of that, you become a free agent. And 95, and you timed it beautifully. You hit 302, 22 home runs, a lot of stolen bases, and you were probably one of the two or three premier free agents on the market. Had a lot of people coming at you at that time, a lot of teams coming at you, and we had some experiences in several places where we met with Tony La Russa and Walt Jocketty from the Cardinals. We met with John Moores and Kevin Towers from the Padres. Bob Gebhardt from the Rockies. But that was a grueling experience for the two of us, and especially for you. So can you take us through that and talk about how that went?
Well, the free, like we were talking about earlier, about being loyal to a city and an organization. And you know, I never wanted to leave. But as you know, as a player, sometimes like, listen, I don't want to go. But I mean, if you're going to make me go, then I don't have a choice. So Barry and I tried to play this out as long as we could until it's a little bit different then. Like, you want to have your free agency done by early December, late November, early December. Now it goes into like during spring training at times now, sometimes some players. But yet it was one of those situations where you didn't want to leave. Fan base didn't want you to leave. Houston wasn't calling. And we were like, so I told my wife, I said, I got to make my mind up. And, I'm a Catholic kid or whatever. And I said, all right, I'm going to go to a church. And I sat in this church for 5 hours. I literally, just 4 to 5 hours, the lights were off. It was dark. I just sat in there, and you start spinning everything through your mind and going, I don't want to leave, but I don't have a choice. I don't want to leave. And so then I left the church, and I told my wife what I was going to do. And then I told Barry, I said, you know, if we don't have a choice, we got to go, and we're going to move. So I left the church, called Barry and said, okay, we got to go to plan B and, let's see what happens. And then Barry could probably answer the question better than I can. What happened after that?
Well, I can tell you from my point of view, I'm looking for Craig because, as he said, back in the day, most free agency was over by the winter meetings, or you would finish it up there, which was early December. Now it goes on forever, but we were getting criticized for taking so long. What's taking so long? Come on, make a decision. And as he said, the Astros had pretty much almost invited him to go out and take a look around. And that's not what he wanted to hear as a loyal player, but we did. And then it became enticing because they were offering a lot of money. As it turns out, Craig ended up signing back in Houston for less money than he could have gotten elsewhere. But during that five-hour period, I got teams calling me. I got writers calling me going, when are you guys going to make a decision? I go, I can't find Craig. I'm trying to call him. He's in church making his decision. And he finally decided, you know, Houston's what we want. And to Craig's credit, on more than one occasion, he's apologized to me saying, I know I'm costing you money, but I need to stay in Houston. That's what I want to do. And that makes me very proud. I was happy about the result finally.
And Craig, I mean, the reality is your loyalty really trumped all that. I think an interesting dynamic, and you mentioned it, your wife, Patty, having the ability to have that conversation, how do you make that decision? Is it comfort over the price, or what was that for you in talking it with your wife?
We're going to have a nice lifestyle back in the day. You know what I mean? The numbers are different now than they were then. And basically, listen, I mean, I didn't have a lot growing up. Okay. I wasn't a rich kid. I wasn't a poor kid, but we made best of what we had. Right. So then, you know, you get an opportunity to live this dream and go about, you know, living the dream and doing all this stuff. And then you're like, you know, listen, Barry knows we don't kind of live our means. You know what I mean? Like we're good with my credit card works and this and that. And what ends up happening is my wife's in on the conversation and she's just like, listen, I respect you, honey, whatever you're going to do, whatever you feel is right for us and the family, then we're going to support you on it. And I think that's, you know, we've been married 31 years. And I think the reason why we're married 31 years is she let me go do my thing. Okay. And go play. And then she took care of the family. And we really didn't have any problems. And she never really dove into the business side of it and that aspect of it from like, I trust you, I love you. And then we're going to make this work, hon. You've been doing great. And whatever you decide to do and you feel is right, then we're going to support you on it. And then that's what we're going to do. But, you know, she didn't want to leave Houston either, but it was still, you know, at the time it was like, if we don't have a choice, we don't have a choice. We got to find a good opportunity to go. What's going to be the next chapter in our life. And then at the last minute of the last day, it all worked out.
Sween, you know, I think you ask a really insightful question about the role of the wife. As I recall it, there were moments when it wasn't all compatible. I felt like a referee a couple of times when Patty had her opinions. I love Patty. She's one of my favorite people on earth. But there were some differences of opinions during the course of all this, but they are... The great thing about Craig and Patty is they were able to talk it out, as Craig said, and Patty said, you know, your decision, you go do it. And it's turned out fairly well so far. So
isn't that what they say though, about a good arrangement, whether it's a marriage or with a business partner, an agent, you got to have somebody challenging you to be a critical thinker. You want to have that, don't you, Craig, where you're going, am I seeing this clearly? And you want that feedback, don't you?
100%. Yeah. I mean, you know, you don't want anybody like, oh, whatever you say, honey, you know, yeah, you're the best right now in this house. Like, yet again, you got to be able to work your way through it. And then at the end of the day, when the decision's made, you're all going to go down the same path together. So there's no reason to, you know, you try to any negotiation, you work it out. And this is a complicated life, man. People, you know, think it's so easy. You know, I think, you know, one of the hardest things to do is really staying with the team for 20 years. That's hard to do. You look at what Tony Gwynn did, you know, George Brett did, you know, Don Mattingly before he got hurt. It's hard to stay with a team, Cal Ripken, you know, throughout your career. I mean, there's, you know, it's a give and take relationship with both sides. And sometimes you're like, it's going to work and sometimes it's not going to work. But yet again, you know, in your household, it's got to work. You know what I mean? And I think that, I think what happens with a lot of players a lot of times is that they think the grass is always greener on the other side. And ask any old baseball player, they'll tell you that all the time. They always think the grass is greener. Then they get over there and they're like, why did I leave? Hell, I had it so good. All right. So I took a little less, but you're happy. Your kids are happy. You know what I mean? Who cares? You know, you're still going to have the credit card's going to work. And that's all.
Yeah. Right? I love it, Beej, because from my perspective, a player in the game that was just thrilled to put a uniform on, I always marveled on longevity and also being able to be loyal. And those are two words that I think resonate when I think of Craig Biggio and also the iconic names that you mentioned. I'd love to do this because you settle into your career and we talk about the finances, the contracts, all that stuff. You're identified by winning and also your teammates. And I think that is something that's really fun for this podcast to hear the aspects of it. You're connected, and we'll touch on your Hall of Fame career, your Hall of Fame enshrinement. But you're connected with one of the best, and this is Jeff Bagwell. We'll get into the Killer Bees, but Jeff Bagwell and you are lockstep in the Astros uniform. Speak to your relationship with Jeff.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, we were two East Coast kids that, you know, we didn't know anything about Texas. I got there a little earlier than he did, but yet he was a Boston Red Sox and was like, East Coast kid, he's going to be a Sox, Carl Yastrzemski, Jim Rice, and all the boys, you know. Then all of a sudden, you know, 1989 or 90, whatever year it was, all of a sudden he becomes a Red Sox and he comes to the Astros. And he's like, damn, I was going to live my dream. My father was a Red Sox fan and this and that. And then all of a sudden, you know, we make the trade and, you know, we got a good little power hitter guy that, you know, he didn't have a lot of power as much then because he played in a big ballpark. And then he's a third baseman. And then we already have a third baseman that's already in our organization named Ken Caminiti, who won an MVP out there in San Diego.
Yeah.
And well, he's not better than him. And then like, okay, Yogi Berra goes, well, he hits too good and he's not going to play third. Then we'll put him at first. So Baggy learns how to play first base in 2 weeks. So he takes his third baseman glove. You give him the taco. He goes over to first base. And then, you know, 14 years, you know, I couldn't have picked a better guy to play with teammate wise on and off the field. And I mean, he knew me as well as I knew anybody. And I knew him as well as we knew anybody. I think that's what really made us really work unbelievable together. I set the table. He drove me in. You know what I mean? It was kind of like, and we won a lot of games that way. And then obviously before he hurt his shoulder, on the right side of the field. I mean, we had a lot of fun over there, man. He was good. He was great. You know, people remember a little bit at the end with his shoulder and everything. Defensively with the glove and the way that he can move and sort of be next to him side by side for whatever it was. I think we played 15 years, but we were side by side for a dozen. That was a lot of fun over there. So, and then when he finally got in the Hall of Fame, you know, for us to go in together was something that we'll never forget. And the one thing that we always talked about was that, you know, we're going to go play, we're going to do our thing, but we want to bring a championship to Houston. So we always talked about the World Series. We want to win a World Series. We want to win a World Series. We're not a big market. Like when you guys played in San Diego, you're not a big market, but you got to get a lot of things right. You know what I mean? So for he and I, we got to the playoffs that didn't go well. We got the playoffs that didn't go well. And then it started to go well. And then we got to the World Series. That was the accumulation of like, we're finally letting the air out and going, man, we're going the World Series. You know what I mean? Like some guys get an opportunity to go a lot. Okay. But I got to go one time as a player. And it was one of the greatest things that I ever had an opportunity to do because it was the same thing. It takes you back to your childhood days. You know what I mean? Where you're just like a little kid going the World Series. And for Baggy and I to do that together, that's all we wanted to do. And we changed the culture there in Houston. And we take a lot of pride in that. And you know, we respected our teammates. And so to be in the Hall of Fame with him together, is really special.
You know, one of the things that I recall about that relationship is, Craig, when you got your 3,000th hit, of course, there's a celebration on the field. Patty comes down. The kids are there, of course, on the field, you know, hugs. And all of a sudden you're looking for somebody. And you're looking for Jeff, who uncharacteristically came down. That's not really his style to have the limelight, but uncharacteristically he came down and you called him onto the field to be with you. That was the greatest indication of the closeness you guys had and what it had been for you guys to be teammates.
Well, that was pretty, you know, you were there. That was, you know, 3,000 hits is pretty special. And to be able to give it to the city like we were able to do at the end was like my way of saying thank you to you fans for being nice to us. But for Baggy and I, you know, like, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. And then Gar was yelling. And then I'm like, well, what? And then he's yelling, there's Baggy. And I'm like, you know, he didn't want to come out to the field. And, you know, the game was taken away from him. And so we really didn't have an opportunity to walk off the field together. And he said, what? I said, come here. And then I said, we're going. He and I had this thing, you know, like, you know, when we're playing the game, we're between the white lines. And when the game is over, we don't step back over the white line until the game starts the next day. So I said, come on. He goes, what? I go, let's go. We got to go between the lines one more time. Let's go. This is good. This is, I don't care what the fine's going to be. You're in street clothes. I don't care. Let's just go. I'll take care of the fine. Let's just go do it for the fans one more time. And it's a moment that I'll never forget. Cause I mean, we, it's 14, 15 years. You've been through a lot of things together, man, on the field, you know, good, bad, ugly, work, sweat, injuries. And then to be able to have that moment, have him come out and pull him out and make him do something that he didn't want to do. I enjoy that more than.
Bija, I mean, you guys are the unselfish guys. And for our listeners, the people don't know, that right side of the infield was represented by Barry. He also represented Jeff Bagwell. So that's the reason why he was there too, signifying that moment. You mentioned something that was interesting, and I think a lot of players would love to say, you know what? I got to leave the game the way I wanted to. You mentioned that, and that's the reason why I bring it up now. You got to go off the field against the Atlanta Braves and be the defensive replacement. You come off the field. What was that like? What do you remember about that moment?
Most players have the game taken away from them. So for me, I had a storybook career where, you know, we did our thing, we played, and then at the end, I made my own decision to walk away. So I was good with the fact that, like, you know, it's time for me to go home. It's time for me to be a better husband. It's time for me to be a better father. As you know, we're never there for your kids when they're playing little league games and all this other stuff when, you know, they really need you because you're playing. So, you know, for me, you know, when you come off the field, and obviously with Bobby Cox and the Atlanta Braves, we've got a lot of history together, respectful history together, where, you know, every first round we play them. So they sent us home three times. We sent them home. They sent us home three times in the playoffs. We sent them home twice. So we had a lot of respect there amongst each other, and to be able to have them be part of that, and then have my kids in the dugout, I was good with going home. I was ready to go home, and I was ready to go for that next chapter in my life. I'm not going to tell you, it took me a while to take my uniform off because I knew that, you know, and the next time you take these spikes off, I mean, they're off. You know, you're not going to be like going home and go, I changed my mind, I'm going to come back. We're good. It's time to go home. So I guess, you know, having to be able to do it the way that I did it, and to have all the fans there. And when the game was over, I didn't know what to do. I didn't really want to do the Cal Ripken thing, but then all the fans weren't leaving. So I kind of had to go around the field. And, it's a memory in my mind that I'll never forget because, I love Houston and the fan base has been so great to me. And to be able to have that happen, my family, and then go in the next chapter of my life was something I'll never forget.
I think that's really cool that you get to, walk it off, as they say, on your terms, when so many guys don't have that opportunity. So congratulations to you on that and all the memories you have left for this legion of loyal fans. I really find it to be remarkable because I think you guys made an interesting point earlier, how few guys play their entire career, especially one 20 years long, with one organization. And then you bring a playoff atmosphere to it and you bring a World Series opportunity for yourself there, as we talked about in 05 against the Sox. Take me through, though, that postseason slice of your professional life. Your first time in is in 97, the division series against Atlanta. As you said, Atlanta kind of got the better of you guys for a while because it ties in, I think, interestingly, with Mark's 1998 Padres and Barry kind of straddling the fence there on both sides, Craig.
Well, he was in a win-win situation anyway because he knew people on both sides.
Yeah.
He's going to have some bad calls and he's going to have some happy calls, you know, you know, 97, I think 97 was the playoffs that, I mean, we were just young and Atlanta was polished and we thought we were ready for him and we were not ready for him. And then 98, I think we had the best team. And then Mark, I think we came across you guys right. And Kevin, yep. You guys had Kevin Brown out there in San Diego, which was like, we were right-handed dominant team. And up until 2017, I thought that was the best team that the Astros have ever had. even though we didn't go to the World Series that year. You know, and then, but you take bits and pieces of, you know, the playoffs. But then again, getting the opportunity to finally go to the World Series that one year, was like, just took you back to when you were a little kid. Like, we are going to the World Series, you know, some guys that never get a chance to say that, you know, and they were great players and Hall of Famers, you know, it wasn't from lack of trying. It just didn't work out. But, you know, the playoffs, you remember different pieces of things that have happened in those games and those series. And it wasn't from lack of effort. I believe a lot of times I'm a destiny guy, man. I just, things happen. Why they happen, it's not for us to answer, but they just happen. You think the guy wanted to strike out? You think the guy wanted to throw a wild pitch? You think Bill Buckner wanted to have the ball go between his legs?
Right.
No, it's just destiny happens, man. You just hope it's your destiny and not somebody else's.
Beej, I always want to go back to 98, not because my team won. I think it's one of those. I think it's one of those series that the lead up was so great because we had Kevin Brown on our side. You guys go and acquire the big unit, Randy Johnson. He is 10-1 with you guys leading into the playoffs, and like you said, the most talented. Probably Astros team, if you look at that roster, you go, oh my gosh. And as an opposition, we were saying the same thing. Don't get us wrong, because it is the big unit. But also, statistically, you had your best year of your career. You were coming in as leading the charge. 50 stolen bases, 50 doubles. You're the second one in baseball history. A guy named Tris Speaker did it in 1912. No big deal, right? You're doing it. But I think it's interesting. You guys have the killer bees. You're going into this series. And I think the listeners don't understand. It was a four-game series, and the first three games were one-run results. So everything was very close. You had the big unit. What do you remember about that series? Because the winner had to take on the Atlanta Braves that you already had that challenge with.
Right. Pretty much. I mean, from what I remember, I mean, you know, we had Kevin Brown game one and game three. We had some off days in between there, which allowed him to come back. Right. So it was kind of like, wow, like how did we get stuck with him on game one and game three? Right. we had unit when, and then you had, we had unit go on game one, and then he came back for game four, but that was against Sterling Hitchcock.
Yep.
Which was when you're playing the West Coast, people forget. And this is where let me tell you something for the Hall of Fame voters, please. Oh my God, he's one of the greatest managers of all time. Amazing. The players play against each other. And then when you play against a Bruce Bochy team, you don't beat him. You have to beat the players. And that was the great thing about Boch, is that he put all his players in situations to be successful. He was like the Bobby Coxes, man. They were magicians. They were amazing. But then it was Sterling Hitchcock for game four against Unit. And they're like, you know, you get a 3 o'clock day game in San Diego. And everybody's like, well, it's great on the East Coast, unless you're on the West Coast, because you can't even see the ball in batting practice, right, let alone a game being played. So Sterling did great. Okay. I think he had Atlanta again in a 3 o'clock game.
Yep.
Again later on. And it didn't work out for us. So that's okay. So again, I believe in destiny. It wasn't ours. It was yours. I was happy for Cammy, happy for yourself, you know, in San Diego. So it was great.
That's an interesting aspect. And that's another reason why I wanted to bring it up too. Not the results. It has everything to do with one of your former teammates, Ken Caminiti, our third baseman, 1996 MVP. But this was a situation where it really resonates with you. Your relationship with the late Ken Caminiti, I thought the world of him. He has three beautiful daughters. This was a guy that was a warrior. And on that big stage, he was so great because he loved those challenges. What was your relationship like with the late Ken Caminiti?
Oh, Cammy is, you know, he's one of my best friends, obviously. He's one of my best friends. I've known him, you know, his daughter's here right now in New Jersey, spending the week here. So she's my wife and his ex-wife, Nancy, is here. I mean, she's not here, but they're best friends. The relationship that we have is inseparable. They're beautiful girls. But my relationship with Cammy is one of my best friends. And you know, when, you know, we lost, I mean, we're happy for him. I mean, he has an opportunity to go to the World Series. He's a California kid. He came from California, went to college in California. So, I mean, the storybook for him out there was great. But my relationship with Cammy was, you know, we were, you know, 19. He got to the big leagues in 87. I got to the big leagues in 88. And then we just kind of go through the growing pains together until we finally start winning. And then he left and then came back and then left. And then, you know, but as far as your relationships are concerned, Mark, like, you know, it's like, you know, you might put on different uniforms, but you're friends for life. And he was one of my best friends. And again, he's, you know, I have a ranch. It's named Campbell Ranch for Caminiti Biggio. You know, I used to hunt with my dad. And then he had a ranch that he was on a lease. And he asked me to be partners with him on it. And I said, let me bring my kids down. And they loved it. And then the rest was history. But yeah, Cammy was a great, unbelievable third baseman. If anybody wants to know how great of a third baseman Caminiti was, I showed a video to a GM the other night. I go, you remember the Ken Caminiti play he did from his butt on the line? And he goes, kind of. I go, hold on a second. You YouTube Ken Caminiti throw from third base on the line. And Sween, was that you? Were you at first?
No, that was, I think, it might have been Wally Joyner.
Scott Livingston.
Yeah, Scott Livingston. Yeah, that's right.
He's laying on the line on his butt, and he throws it to the first baseman sitting on his butt, and he throws a dart, like, chest high. And he threw the guy, I don't even remember who hit it, but he threw him out by, like, two steps. It wasn't even close. It was like, that's all you have to do is watch that video to show how great that man was at what he did defensively. He was Brooks Robinson of our era, and then he finally was able to get a gold glove or two at the end. And but the thing about Cammy, he looked like a Harley Davidson Hell's Angel type guy.
Yeah.
He was the biggest teddy bear in the world. You know yourself. Like, yeah. He would give you anything, and he didn't care. He just looked mean, but he didn't have a bad bone in his body.
You know, the reason I remember is Scott Livingston is because I've been around him. Sween, I know you've heard him say this, but Livingston will say, yeah, everybody talks about Caminiti on that play. They don't realize the part I played in that play. If I hadn't caught that ball, it would have put a hole in my chest. That's his line. But in regard to Craig, you have provided me with so many opportunities and memories. And one of them in regard to Cammy was when your Hall of Fame induction weekend. And this is just to point out the closeness of the Caminitis. Craig's guests of honor, really, besides his family, were Nancy and the three girls. And I can remember being invited on the tour down to the where they keep everything stored down below. And they showed the girls Cammy's file with all the great things that he had done, and then pulled out the bat that he had used to hit home run from each side of the plate one day and then did it again the next day. And they have that as an artifact at the Hall of Fame. And I actually have some pictures of the girls holding the bat, but along with other memories, I got to say some of the things that stick out to me most were being able to be present with you at a lot of important phone calls. One of which was, I wasn't at the call when you got called to the big leagues, because that wasn't a call, of course, but then, to what we thought were going to be calls, being at your home waiting for the calls from the Hall of Fame in the first 2 years of your eligibility when they didn't come, and the disappointment that we lived through with that. And then the third one where the call came and the excitement that came about because of that. I was also able to be present at the call when I was at your house in Houston when Kevin was drafted by the Blue Jays, which was an exciting moment. But I just want you, those calls and one more, I want to ask you how they rate with you. Your call to the Hall of Fame, your call to the big leagues, Kevin's call when he was drafted, or Kevin when he told you he was going to the big leagues. How do you rank those calls?
I'm part of the greatest team ever assembled as far as being a Hall of Fame member. And as you sat in my kitchen, you know, when you're sitting there waiting for a phone call to come and then it doesn't come, and you never know if it's going to happen the next year or not. You never know whatever's going to happen from that. But then obviously to get that phone call in the third year is a phone call that you will never, ever forget, because you never play the game to get in the Hall of Fame. You play the game. I love the game. It's fun to play the game. I came from a little town in Long Island, New York, you know, and worked my way up and ended up in Texas and did my thing there. And then I got a call to be able to go to Cooperstown, you know, and then that call doesn't happen unless, you know, you get the call up in 1988, you know, when you're in AAA, right? But I got to say, you know, the phone call when my son got drafted was really, and Barry, we, and everybody on the Zoom call, we all love our children the same, you know? But then when your son gets a phone call that he's going to get drafted, and then he gets drafted in the fifth round, you're like, man, he's got a chance. He's got an opportunity. And then when your son calls you, when you're here, and I'm like, he calls us and he says, hey, what are you doing? I go, yeah, we're just sitting on the back porch and we're getting ready to, you know, is there something that you need us to bring you to Lehigh, whenever the heck we were going to go to watch them play? And he goes, I think you need to, and he goes, no, I don't forget nothing. He goes, I just think you need to, you might want to change your point of destination. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, I'm going to the show. So now all of a sudden, like, your kid, you know, is trying to do the same thing you did. And then all of a sudden your son gets that phone call. And then the next day, you know, 24 hours later, you're in Toronto watching your son play against the San Diego Padres. And I'll never forget that ever, because that's what his dreams are. He's got in this house here, he's got my first All-Star game was from the Toronto Blue Jays. It's been hanging above his bed here for 30 something years. He got drafted by the Blue Jays, and then he got an opportunity to go to the big leagues and chase his own dreams down. That, to me, that is something I'll never forget it. I mean, because it's like anybody that's a son of as a son that's playing, that's trying to get there. And then obviously it's what we did. And then they're getting an opportunity to do it. I'll never forget that call.
Beej, take us into that, the first day for your son, Calvin, in the big leagues. You make the trek. You're not going to miss that game. You know how important that is. That perspective to me, and especially the cameras catching you, because this isn't about your moment, it's about your son's moment. But man, let's be honest, a 20-year career, and then here comes your son making that debut. What was that like for you and emotionally, and the day itself?
Well, the game couldn't get there quick enough. You know, you're like, come on, man, let's go to BP, let's go. You know, there he is, he's got number 8 on, Yogi Berra, Cav, he's got that number. That's great on, look at that, damn. And then you watch the game, and then you're just like, okay, hopefully he makes all the plays in the field, and then you're like, please get a hit. You know, don't do like an 0 for 30. Dad was 0 for 13, you know, like, come on, get the kid, get a hit. He didn't get a hit the first game. And then it was either the second game or the third game, he had a couple of hits. So he had a homer, which was a bomb.
Yeah.
It was a bomb. And then you're like, hey, man, God bless you. Good luck. This is going to be so much fun to watch you play.
Speaking of the bombs, he makes his first visit as a visitor to Houston, and he's in a Blue Jays uniform. You're in the stands, obviously, and he hits another bomb. What was that reaction like? How'd that feel for you?
Well, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, people like, you know, you don't stand up for your kid. You don't. I'm an internal guy, man. You know, like, you know, you're in a dugout. The game's different now. You know what I mean? Everybody's doing the whole whatever.
Oh, yeah.
Going on, right? So back in the day, you would have done that. You'd have got one in the ear hole, you know?
Yeah.
You know, you learn that I'm an internal guy, man. I'm just, things are going inside and I don't care. Listen, I still work with the team. I want them to hit 4 homers against us, you know what I mean? But as long as, you know, Houston wins, I don't care. Kid does great. But it's like, he hit a couple up there in Toronto against them that year. And then this Father's Day, he had a homer. Father's Day weekend in Houston this year, he had a home run. So, I mean, you know, it's pretty cool. I mean, and the thing is, like, when he plays in Houston, which is cool, is that, like, the fans, you know, my kids grew up with the fans, you know what I mean? They love them there. You know, they got a couple big chance.
That's awesome.
And they usually throw the ball back in when the visitors hit the homer. and they didn't throw his back in. The guy kept it.
Oh, God.
The guy's like, I ain't giving that ball away.
I was just going to ask you whether it went through your mind that I'm still a consultant and a member of this organization. What am I supposed to do here? You know, my son just hit a home run against the Astros.
Oh, yeah, they don't care. They know. They go, listen, I want Kevin to go 4-for-4 every day. As long as we win, who cares? You know what I mean? It's like somebody's going to have a good day on every other team you play. So why not my kid have a good game? And as long as the Astros win, we're good.
Craig, more nerve-wracking wearing a uniform and being in a pressure-packed situation, or more nerve-wracking sitting in the stands watching your kid?
Sitting in the stands watching your kid, 1,000,000%.
Really? Even I'm putting you in the World Series against the White Sox, the culmination, the pinnacle of your career. You're telling me sitting in the stands watching Kevin was more stressful than playing in the World Series.
You don't control it. I sit in the box. I got a bat in my hand. I control that. I'm sitting in the stands. I don't control anything. It's kind of like you want to put things back in perspective. Go back to anybody that has children and when they're in Little League and they're pitching. And you're just sitting in the stands going, oh, my God, he's trying to throw strikes, but he's throwing them to the backstop. You know what I mean? You're kind of like, you know, you're going back to like, you don't control it. You're like, you just want them to be successful. That's it.
Yeah, Craig, for our listeners, those moments resonate, and especially your pride for what your kids have done. Obviously, Kevin being in the main stage. But let's not minimize it too. You get an important phone call after your third year waiting, as you mentioned. Barry's there to be able to, to hear that phone call. What was that like for you? Do you remember that moment? And do you remember the words that came out on the other end of the phone? And how was that day moving forward?
I think it was the first year. They tell you to put your phone where it's in a good spot from 12 to 1 o'clock or whatever it is that has good reception. So my phone rings the first year, like 12:15, it says New York, New York on it. And I'm like going, New York, hello? Hey, this is so-and-so from some, I can't talk right now, bro. I'm like, anyway, it's a phone call. It's like, you just thought that you were getting a phone call from Cooperstown. And then it was an interview and you're like, oh, right. So anyway, so that doesn't come. And then the next day, next year, you find out that you were like two votes shy. And the only reason why you didn't get in is because they picked up like two or five more riders. So the percentages went, you had the actual number that you needed, but since you didn't, they had more riders, you're below the curve again. So I'm like, okay. So we missed out by two. All right. And then, and then the third year comes and then you're just like, it's very emotional, obviously, because it's like, it's not something that, you know, we didn't play the game for the Hall of Fame, but now you have an opportunity to be part of the greatest team ever. Right. Be part of that fraternity. And, I remember saying to the guy, this is not a joke, is it? This is real. And he goes, no, this is real. It was like, you know, and then the emotions roll and then, you know, you making sure that you're, you know, you got to get on a flight and it was like going to an all-star game. Now you got to like hurry up and get out. But it was like, you know, for my family to all be part of it, Barry was there, you know, to be, you know, you're part of a 1% group of that put on a big league uniform and have the opportunity to play. And now you're part of that team. And I'll never forget it.
You know, what I recall about it is that there's that elation and you think, okay, now we pop the champagne and it's going to get a thing. Now it's a whirlwind. They're getting picked up in an hour to go to the airport to get to New York for the press conference and everything. And I don't remember if you guys were packed before or not, but it was like, you don't want to pack because you're going to offend the baseball gods if you pack. So
pack in the bat bag before the game's over. That's
right.
Right. So I just remember it being such a whirlwind and everything happening so fast.
With all the stuff happening leading up, the developing the speech, getting the most important people in that speech, the Dennis Laborios that you talked about, all your teammates, That is a daunting task in itself. What do you remember about that process? What do you remember about that day, Craig?
Well, I remember that, when you go up to the Hall of Fame, they give you the lay of the land and what's going to happen, what's going to transpire. And then this is what's happened with some people before. And then they tell you that, you know, you don't want to be the guy that sits back down on the chair and go, oh, I forgot to thank Sweeney. And then I got to get up. Yeah. No, you're done. They gave you your plaque. It's, you have to go, you have, so, you know, you write a, in the, you know, I'm not a big public speaker guy. I don't like to do it. I don't enjoy doing it. You know, stuff like this, I enjoy doing off the cuff but it's like, okay, let's get my checklist, you know, write it all down, get all the people down, you know, and then the Hall of Fame calls you back and says, well, we wanted it done in 15 minutes. Like, okay, 15 minutes is a lot of thank yous to get done in a 15 minute capsule. And then, you get it all written out and present it to your wife, and she doesn't like this or does like that. And you forgot about this, and got to put the Sunshine Kids in there. And you're like, okay, yeah, you're right. I got a college grad upstairs at Notre Dame, an MBA from Rice, and he can type it all up. And I'm like, listen, they don't have a teleprompter. They don't have like the president has. You know, I got to be able to see it. You know what I mean? And a typical kid, you know, you got a 15, 17 minute speech, whips it out in like 25 minutes. And I'm like, it would have taken me like a week to type all that down, you know? So, and then you just practice it, and that was it.
What do you remember about that day, Barry, when Craig stood up and gave his speech?
I had confidence that Craig was going to do a great job. I had actually talked to him beforehand about what he was going to say and make sure you don't forget anybody. You know, I tried to do my part and reminding him of, you know, teammates and people like McElhaney and Dennis Laborio and his wife. You know, make sure you remember her. But I had every confidence he was going to do great, and he did do great. I remember it being hot. It's hot out there at Cooperstown when you're sitting out there in the open air in the sun, but you disregard that. What I remember is that John Smoltz in his speech talked about his parents being accordion players and accordion teachers. And Craig, we got back to the hotel and we were going to sit on the veranda and have a beer and cool off. And who sits down next to us but John Smoltz's parents? And Craig has a smart ass brother-in-law who looks at the Smoltzes and said, did you folks bring your accordions with you? I love polka music. That's probably what I remember most.
Hey, Sweeney, but I do remember this. I remember that I said that, hey, listen, because we had four guys. And I said that, look, I was a leadoff guy.
Yeah.
Can I go first? Because I didn't want to be like, I got to follow that guy who's the politician. Or you wanted to follow the guy that was bad. But yet again, I remember after I sat down and then John got up to speak, and then Unit is sitting right next to me and he's sitting there going, you're waiting because you're waiting your time, you know? And I'm like, yeah. I want to go up. I want to get it done. And they're like, you know what? I can sell that right there. You're good. You go first.
Hey, leadoff hitters should lead off, right?
Yeah, yeah, I sat absolutely down. I was like, God, I'm so glad I'm done. You know, Pedro, it didn't matter when he went. He was really fine. When it was like,
Craig, you made a passing reference just a minute ago to the Sunshine Kids. And I know how near and dear that organization has been to your heart. Can you mention that? And specifically, I tried to tell Mike this story last night and I sort of choked up, but specifically talk about game three of the World Series and how that incorporated the Sunshine Kids.
Yeah, the Sunshine Kids, I mean, I'm a national spokesman for them, and they're children with cancer. I've been involved with them for 35 plus years. And they've been, how I got involved with them was that the Larry Anderson Bagwell trade. It started with Joe Sambito in Houston, who was a left-handed pitcher, and he would bring the Sunshine Kids out for a game, bring him out on the field for batting practice, sign some autographs, take some pictures, give him some tickets to go to the games, and then give him some hot dogs and do that type of stuff. So then Larry, when Joe left, Larry got involved. And then when Larry got traded, I was like, I had a newspaper route when I was a kid, and there was a family on my route that their son came down with leukemia, and the young man eventually he lost his life. But I made a promise to the family. I said that if I'm ever in a position, I don't know if I'm ever going to be or not, if I'm ever in a position to give back, I promise you, I will give back. So when Larry left, I was like, well, here's your opportunity here. And then either, you know, you said you were going to do it. So I got involved in back then. And then it's led to this relationship that we've had for 35 plus years. And, the Houston people and the community have been incredible, supportive of the kids and the foundation. And there's so many amazing things that we do. But one of the coolest things was is when Drayton McClain was the owner of the Astros at the time. We were in the World Series, and it was the first Texas team to ever go to the World Series. So we were in Chicago for the first two, and we lost. And then Drayton had said to me, there's a boy named Frankie. So when I met this young man named Frankie, he was 5 years old, and they told me he's got two weeks to live. So I asked the dad, who was during one of these meet and greets that we have in the field, can I take Frankie into the clubhouse? So I take him in the clubhouse. He's 5 years old, and we go to my locker and I go, what do you want? Take whatever you want. Of course, takes the jersey. So yeah. The kid takes the jersey, and then, you know, meet him with all the players, and then he goes and watches the game. And then Frankie was the young man that threw out the first pitch of the first Texas World Series ever. And he's been a near and dear friend of my heart. He's been Jeff Bagwell and I just got in the Houston Hall of Fame. Brad Ausmus did an induction for me. And then Frankie also came up and do it. Frankie's doing amazing. He's in film. We need to hook him up at Harmon, and he's a great kid. He's a great friend. And I mean, that was one of the, you know, there's certain things that happen to you on a baseball field, and this happened before a game. And for Frankie to be able to throw out the first pitch in the Hall of Fame, I mean, the first pitch in a World Series ever to be played in Texas, that was pretty special.
What a great story. I mean, Beach, people don't understand the stuff that you do on the field resonates. But when you can impact somebody's life like Frankie's and be able to have a moment like that, that puts a stamp on everything, in my opinion. Interesting that you have all of these charities that you've done in the Houston area. You're continuing to do the stuff with the Houston Astros organization. What's next for you? What would you like to have happen in the next few years?
You know, I kind of, well, let's get through COVID, right? Let's just kind of, you know, we got this new variant. Just like have everybody be smart about it. I mean, it's still having an impact on us, on everybody, right? So let's get through this phase of it. Let's continue to grow the game to what it's growing at. I mean, Mark, you're in the game. You see these players. What some of these kids can do on a baseball field is beyond belief at times, right? You know, and continue to watch my family and do their, you know, just living life and for people to be healthy and enjoy the little things in life.
Well, Craig, from all of us, including all your legions of fans out there, thank you so much for not only all you've done off the field with the charity work, but for spending some time with us to help us get to know you a little bit better. We do appreciate it. You got it. Craig Biggio, the Hall of Famer, 7-time All-Star, winner of 4 Gold Gloves, 20 seasons in the big leagues, all of them with the Houston Astros. What a treat. Thanks again. Well, folks, thanks for checking out Major League Beginnings presented by Bet Online. And if you had as much fun as we did, please go ahead, hit the subscribe button anywhere you usually download your podcast from. You pick the platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, whatever you like. We're just glad to have you aboard, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.